Hi, my name is Barry Crawford, and welcome to the course entitled Neurobiology, Mindfulness, and Mental Health in the Practice of Law. I'm excited to offer this course because it has two major touch points in my life recently, or really the last couple of decades. One is, I've been meditating or engaging in mindfulness for most of my adult life, and I've even to the point where I'm a certified mindfulness instructor. And I've also worked in legal services for about 15 years now, primarily in CLE, both in working and getting it to customers, but also in creating various courses, including professional responsibility and ethical courses. So I'm very excited to offer this course, and hopefully it's helpful to people. It would be fair to ask, what is the value of this material? You're sitting here, you have to watch this course for the next hour or so to get your CLE credit. And you may be wondering, why would I be interested in such a subject? It's a bit esoteric, so I think that's a fair question. But there's two major reasons to learn how our brains work, regarding mindfulness and mental health and so forth. The first major reason is when we see how our brains engage in the type of activity that causes emotional turbulence, we're often a little less likely to get caught up in it. A good analogy might be let's say, you learn about how marketing tricks affect your behavior. Like, for example, it's pretty obvious to most people, but let's say you learn explicitly that if there's a big orange button that says buy and a smaller link that says, do this later, there's a small part of us that's a little more likely to click on the buy button because it's bigger and it's more in your face and so forth. And so, that small marketing trick is a little bit likely to influence our behavior in a subconscious way. But when we're taught this, and this is a kind of an obvious one, but there's many kind of dark patterns like this in marketing that are harder to detect. But when we learn them and we see them, we're a little bit less likely to get fooled by them. And it works similarly when we're looking at how the brain works and how it causes emotional turbulence. When we see the patterns and we understand what's going on underneath the hood, we're more likely to catch it before it gets out of control and kind of makes life a bit less bumpy overall. Another reason is that mindfulness is objectively good for us. There's plenty of studies that show the health and mental health benefits and productivity benefits of mindfulness. And there's plenty of studies that explain why this works and how this works. And it's in seeing this kind of objective, quantifiable advantages of this is frankly motivating. And it's increases the chance you may pick up an activity like this in your own life. So those are the two major reasons I'm motivated to present a course like this. Okay, let's take a look at what our agenda is going to be today. First, we're going to look at the extent of mental health issues in the practice of law. Then we're going to try to define mental health, so we have some context to understand what we're talking about here. The term mental health in and of itself is kind of nebulous, so I'm going to try to be a bit specific. Then we're going to dive into the sciencey part of this presentation, and we're going to look at the core neurological basis of depression and anxiety and other mental illnesses and see what's going on there. Then we're going to look, is there a solution? Spoiler, there is, mindfulness. And so we're going to look at how mindfulness works. And then we're going to look at a few practical issues on how to bring mindfulness into the practice of law. So now let's look at an overview of what we're going to learn in this course regarding mental health in the practice of law. The main reason that you as an attorney that needs to take CLE courses, you're kind of mandated to attend some CLE courses of this category, is that frankly, mental health issues are widespread in the legal profession. There's been many articles that have covered this issue, and let's look at a couple of them here so we have some context and understand the issues at hand here. The first article I want to look at is entitled Mental Health in the Legal Profession. It's by Michael Scott, believe it or not, is his name. And if you watch the Office, that name may sound a little familiar to you. But the quote from his article is that research has shown that lawyers are prone to stress-related illnesses, including burnout, insomnia, clinical depression, gambling, addiction, and substance abuse. It goes on to say, in a 1990 study, researchers at Johns Hopkins University found that lawyers had 3 times the rate of clinical depression compared to professionals in 25 other occupations. Further research has shown that approximately 15% of lawyers will encounter the same some form of depression during their careers. It continues on. In a study of more than 2,500 lawyers in North Carolina, 1 out of every 4 attorneys reported clinical symptoms of depression, such as loss of appetite, lethargy, suicidal thoughts, or insomnia, at least 3 times a month during the last year. Surveys reveal that as many as 18% of lawyers will develop problems related to substance abuse, compared to only 10 to 11% of the general population. Clearly, there's an issue in this industry. It's not surprising. It's a more stressful industry than most, and it requires insane amount of hours for many people, and especially early in careers where people have to make a name for themselves. It's fairly unparalleled in the amount of stress and competition and burnout that this profession can engender in people. This article quotes 2 major sources, and I thought I'd show them here. The first is by John Clark Jr., and the article is called "We're from the Bar and We're Here to Help You." It's from the GPSOLO magazine, volume 21, in the October-November issue in 2004, and there's the link. And there's another cited source by Andrew M. Paroto, entitled Mental Issues in the Legal Workplace, in the periodical Diversity and the Bar in the May and June 2005 issue. Another article I wanted to quote from is entitled "The Dark Side of Success: A Psychiatrist's Exploration of Depression in the Legal Profession," and you can see the link there. And of course, all these slides are available in the written material section of your course, so feel free to look there if you want to look in depth in these articles. One quote I wanted to show from this article is the following: "The general population is significantly affected by depression, with 17.3 million persons, or 7.1% of all adults in the U.S., reporting having experienced a major depressive episode in 2017. But the proportion of depression among attorneys is considerably higher. According to the ALM's Mental Health and Substance Abuse Survey from 2020, 31.2% of more than 3,800 respondents reported having a depressive disorder. It goes on to say, nevertheless, the stigma associated with mental illness keeps lawyers from getting help immediately. This can cause excessive and prolonged distress, making the problem worse over time. Another good article on this subject is the new study on lawyer well-being reveals serious concerns for the legal profession. And there's the address. And again, this is all available in the written material sections of your course if you want to read these articles yourself. Some statistics in this article are 25% of law students are at risk for alcoholism. 17% of law students suffer from depression. 37% of law students report mild to severe anxiety. 6% of law students report having suicidal thoughts in the last year. Mental health is clearly a problem in the practice of law. The culture of the industry has made it difficult to even admit one has an issue, and even more difficult to get help. Mandated CLE courses such as this are the first steps in trying to rectify these issues. Now let's take a stab at defining mental health. Mental health refers to a state of well-being in which an individual realizes their own potential, can cope with the normal stresses of life, can work productively and fruitfully, and is able to make contribution to their community. It's not simply the absence of mental illness, but also encompasses a positive aspect of mental function and state. The World Health Organization defines mental health as a state of well-being in which the individual realizes his or her own abilities, can cope with the normal stresses of life, can work productively and fruitfully, and is able to make a contribution to his or her community. Mental health includes emotional, psychological, and social well-being and affects how people think, feel, and act. It helps determine how individuals handle stress, relate to others, and make choices. Mental health is important at every stage of life, from childhood and adolescence through adulthood. Common types of mental illnesses are depression, anxiety, PTSD, and ADHD. Ethics, mindfulness, and mental health. This may sound strange, but there is also an ethical component to mindfulness, mental health, and the practice of law. To really understand this, let's look at the ABA rules of ethical conduct. The American Bar Association rules are well known, but in the interest of completeness, let's formally define them. The American Bar Association, or the ABA, has developed a comprehensive set of guidelines known as the Model Rules of Professional Conduct, which serve to dictate the standard of conduct expected of lawyers. They've designed to establish the ethical responsibilities that lawyers should observe in their professional life. It is important to note that while these rules provide a framework, the final authority on legal ethics in any jurisdiction rests with the relevant state laws and court rules. The first rule to look here is Rule 1.1, Competence, Client-Lawyer Relationship. A lawyer shall provide competent representation to a client. Competent representation requires the legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation reasonably necessary for the representation. This is relevant to our current discussion when we move forward and look at Model Rule 1.16, Section A2, which informs lawyers and their firms when they must withdraw or decline work, when physical or mental conditions prevent them from handling the matter concerned with the requisite competence. An ethics view into mental health. Are you able to attend to the needs of a client with reasonable competence? And if you are suffering from substance abuse, deep depression, anxiety, compulsively avoiding work, then it's reasonable to ask, are you competent to work with this current client? And so we're not just talking about our own mental illness, our own mental health here, which is clearly important, perhaps the most important thing. But as professionals, professional attorneys must ask, are they doing service to their client with where they are mentally in their lives in the current moment? Now we're going to look at the kind of the more nerdy and sciencey aspects of this. We're going to take a dive into how our brains work in the relevant ways regarding mindfulness and mental health. To really understand what causes many types of mental illnesses and how mindfulness helps, it is essential to understand the underlying neurobiology of how the brain works. In this presentation, we will look at the following networks in our brains: the default mode network, the central executive network, the dorsal attention network, and the salience network. That's a lot of networks, and you know, there's no expectations you could memorize all these, but these, I wanted to provide a high-level overview of what we're going to talk about so you're not surprised by any terms, and we'll go into some detail on how all these work. Have you ever wondered why people suffer so much, feel pervasive discontentment, get so easily bored, have unhealthy eating habits, or experience mental health issues? Neurobiologists have recently come to understand what the underlying neurological sources of these issues are. There's a main culprit, and it is the brain's default mode network. The brain's default mode network is the primary culprit and creating pervasive dissatisfaction in our lives. There is a network of regions in the human brain, which we call the default mode network. It is the brain network that is most active when we are not doing a difficult task or when we are thinking or obsessing about ourselves. The default mode network's excessive activation has been implicated in many studies to correlate to unhappiness and mental health issues. Disruptions of the default mode network have been implicated in many mental disorders or learning work disabilities. These include depression, anxiety, PTSD, procrastination, and substance abuse disorders. And let's look at some examples of some studies now. It's a pretty big claim that many, if not most, of our mental health issues stem from a problematic default mode network. So in support of these, I'm going to cite some scientific studies. Some of the language is quite technical, so I'll do my best to translate it into plain English when I can as I'm going along. The first study is called Resting State Functionality Connectivity of the Default Mode Network Associated with Happiness. And some quotes from the article. The default mode network is normally active during rest and is implicated in rumination. We hypothesize that unhappiness may be associated with increased default mode network functional connectivity during rest. Hyperconnectivity to these areas may be associated with higher levels of rumination. So stated simply, if the default mode network is too active, more active than, you know, might be optimal, and is spending too much time thinking about you, or me thinking about me, then we're more likely to experience unhappiness. The article goes on to say, 148 healthy participants underwent a resting state fMRI scan. And an fMRI is, you know, when people go into these big tubes and they take real-time views of what's going on in the brain. So we can actually correlate specific mental activity with specific regions of the brain and its activation. To go on with the article, results indicated that increased functional connectivity in the default mode network was associated with lower levels of happiness. These results highlight the important role of the default mode network in the neural correlates of happiness. It suggests that rumination may play an important role in people's perceived happiness. The default mode network is also implicated in procrastination. And the article I'm going to cite, the study that I'm going to cite to support this, is entitled Identifying the Neural Substrates of Procrastination, a Resting State fMRI Study. The first thing I want to quote from the study is, these results suggested that procrastination could be attributed to, on the one hand, hyperactivity of the default mode network that overrides the prefrontal control signal. In other words, the prefrontal control signal is, you know, the Spock part of our brain, the logic, the decision-making part of our brain. Anyway, it says, while on the other hand, the failure of the top-down control exerted at the prefrontal cortex or anterior prefrontal cortex on the DMN. In other words, when the prefrontal cortex is not able to control the default mode network, we have a hard time focusing. It goes on. Therefore, the present study unravels the biomarkers of procrastination and provides treatment targets for procrastination prevention. The next paper I want to explore is called Brain Networks of Happiness: Dynamic Functional Connectivity Among Default Cognitive and Salience Networks Relates to Subjective Well-Being. This paper says, functional connectivity between the salience network and the default mode network plays an important role in subjective well-being. And what to code that a little bit, the salience network is the brain network that scans your body and scans the environment to try to figure out what's going on, what's salient in your life. And if it discovers something that's salient or important, it alerts the correct brain networks to deal with it. So to go on, patients with mental disorders who exhibit a low level of happiness show disruptive equilibrium between the default mode network and the salience network. For instance, an increased interaction between the default mode network and the salience network has been reported in post-traumatic stress disorder. An increased connectivity between the insula, which is a component of the salience network, and the default mode network was associated with higher self-report anxiety. So in other words, when the salience network is too often saying, hey, default mode network, you really should be worrying about yourself and worrying about the world. So why don't you spend some time worrying about this and stressing out? We're more likely to experience some sort of mental unsatisfactory situations. It's so basically the salience network is being overly eager in alerting the default mode network to worry and ruminate about our lives. The article goes on to say, these may suggest that an enhanced default mode network to salience network connectivity, which is involved in sustained hypervigilance and hyperarousal, is harmful to well-being. In brief, our finding of a negative correlation may account for the fact that people with low levels of subjective well-being are sensitive to negative emotional events, while people with high levels of subjective well-being are associated with good mental adaptability and resilience. So again, they're saying that a salience network that isn't overly eager to turn on the default mode network, in other words, the network in our brain that makes us think and ruminate about ourselves, it is correlated to how happy we are. Now we're going to look at an article that's called Meta-Analysis of Cortical Thickness Abnormalities in Medication-Free Patients with Major Depressive Disorder. And they say here, this meta-analysis provides evidence for a regional cortical thickness alterations in major depressive disorder, mainly involving increased cortical thickness in the default mode network. So what they're saying here is they're saying that actually a default mode network, and remember the default mode network is the brain regions that coordinate to create self-referential thinking and worrying about ourselves. In people where the default mode network is actually thicker and bigger, and thickness in a brain region usually correlates to more connections between the neurons. So in other words, there's more going on there. Is correlated to us being very unhappy in this situation. So again, we're showing how the default mode network is implicated in human unhappiness. So I'm going to cite one last study here to kind of prove my point here regarding the importance in the default mode network and causing us to have mental issues. And it's entitled Instability of the Default Mode Network Connectivity in Major Depression, a two-sample confirmation study. So to quote from this paper, a recent meta-analysis of static connectivity studies in major depression demonstrate hyperconnectivity within the default mode network and between the default mode network and the frontal parietal systems. Within the default mode network, the subsystem connecting the medial prefrontal cortex with the posterior cingulate cortex is considered pivotal in generating effective self-directed judgments and thoughts. So to translate that, what those two parts, the medial prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex, they're the main components of the default mode network that work together to think about ourselves, you know, to ruminate about ourselves, to ruminate, to worry about what's going on in our lives. And when they're overly active, the result is depression. Even in someone who doesn't have a major depressive disorder, if you're worrying too much about yourself and you're stressing out too much, this means you have an overly active default mode network. So to sum up these studies and kind of put it in plain English, when the me or I want part of the brain becomes too powerful or stuck in this rumination, we suffer symptoms like depression and anxiety. So we've talked about the default mode network and how it causes problems. So let's take a moment here and kind of look into how it works and to give us some insight into how it might be causing these problems. A closer look at the default mode network. The default mode network is responsible for the self. The default mode network is in charge of self-referential thinking. It is a source of concepts regarding our sense of identity, and it conceptualizes who we think we are and how we relate to others. It is the basis of our self-identity. The default mode network is responsible for thinking about the past and the future. The default mode network is responsible for thinking, often worrying about what will happen to us in the future. It uses what it believes has happened in the past as the basis for future-oriented thinking. And I say it believes is because, frankly, many of our memories are simply false. So the default mode network can only work based on what we remember. And, you know, this is out of scope for this discussion, but the truth is we very frequently do not remember things correctly or make erroneous observations about what we remember. The default mode network is responsible for narrative thinking. It has the responsibility for figuring out what the narrative rules of the world are in terms of what it thinks will keep us safe and what will make us feel good, how to avoid feeling bad. It keeps a reality map of the world from a self-referential perspective. It is a collection of the internal stories that we believe about the world in relation to ourselves. The default mode network is responsible for clinging and grasping to expected outcomes. The default mode network has extremely strong preferences that the positive and pleasant things and situations in our lives persist and stick around. The world, however, is dynamic and changing place. And when good things go away, the default mode network is designed to make us feel upset about this. The default mode network is responsible for habitual thinking and behavior. The default mode network is empowered to hijack our behavior and thoughts and force us to habitually think and behave in ways that are based on just ideas on what it determines we need in the future. In short, the default mode network is the neurological basis of our narrative ideas about who we are and how the world works. It is also the neurological basis of how we habitually think and behave. The fundamental problem is that the default mode network's narrative stories about who we are and what we need out of life are very often based on faulty assumptions about reality. They are too often based on memories that are overly skewed towards negativity to the point of delusion. Also, just due to the nature of an ever-changing and chaotic world, it is inevitable that the default mode network's expectations will frequently not be met, which leads to frequent discontentment and often significant suffering in life. We spend too much of our time in trance-like and self-obsessed narrative thinking and worrying. It's a trance that keeps us separate and abstracted from the reality of the present moment. The default mode network is obviously useful from a survival perspective. But if we want to thrive and not to survive, we must find ways to limit its out-of-control operation. Obviously, it would be helpful to find a way to neurologically downregulate the default mode network when it's not acting in our own best interest. Since the default mode network is so pervasive in how we view and interact with the world, and since it is implicated in so many mental problems, is there a solution? Or at least, is there a solution that does not involve medication? Which, you know, for many people does not work or has serious side effects. Well, how about one solution? How about thinking our way out of the problem? Can we just analyze situations and think our way out of our problems here? So talking about thinking our way out of problems, let's look at the central executive network. As we look for a candidate for something that can possibly get to the can get the default mode network under control, let's take a look at another brain network, the central executive network. The central executive network is in charge of what neuroscientists call cognitive control. This basically means that it is in charge of deliberately solving short-term challenges in ways that do not rely on instincts or automatic habitual thinking and behavior. If you're doing tasks such as trying to discover the source of a mysterious beeping in the middle of the night, deciding when to drive to work to avoid rush hour traffic, or figuring out how to assemble IKEA furniture, then you're exercising the problem-solving cognitive control functions of the central executive network. You could think of this as a sort of free will because deliberation and reason are involved in deciding how to perform tasks. Since this brain network is so good at analyzing and solving problems in a deliberate and self-controlled manner, it seems logical that it would be the perfect tool for the job of controlling the habit-based and frequently out-of-control default mode network, right? Wouldn't reason and logic be the perfect antidote to an out-of-control and excessive self-referential worry? Wouldn't deliberate problem-solving override delusional assumptions about ourselves and the world we live in? Unfortunately, it's not that simple. The truth is, the central executive network has almost no control over the default mode network. Certainly, almost no control when the default mode network is being driven by strong emotions. As it turns out, the problem-solving central executive network has really a surprisingly small amount of control over the default mode network. This is why we can't simply think away most of our problems. For example, one might find themselves worrying about something that may go wrong in the future. The analytical central executive network might analyze the situation and realize that a bad outcome is unlikely and that it is a waste of time to worry. Unfortunately, the default mode network can often decide, despite our desires, to ignore the central executive network's analysis and do whatever it wants. If one's worried needlessly, there's very little that the central executive network can do about it. The default mode network will also often override our deliberate desires to act in certain ways. For example, the central executive network might analytically determine that eating too much cake is bad for you. Again, if the default mode network decides it wants excessive cake, it's likely going to get what it craves. The central executive network is very likely to fail in its attempt to use reason and logic in its attempt to control habitual behaviors, such as eating too much cake, even when we know better. Often we cannot think away our problems. We can rarely reason our way out of habitual behavior. So if the solution is not the central executive network and its logical, purposeful reasoning, what is the solution? The mindfulness solution. The solution to our excessive self-obsession and habitual thinking and behavior is to live with our life, to live life with our attention firmly planted in the present moment, in present moment awareness. Being in the present moment has become, frankly, quite type of almost a cliche, but I want to show scientifically why this is so important. This dynamic is all about states of mind. To have our attention firmly focused on the present moment is a state of mind. The trance-like thinking mode, where we excessively ruminate about our lives or act habitually, is also a state of mind. These two states of mind are like a seesaw. When one is happening, the other is diminished. It is an actual biological fact that they cannot be both active at the same time. When we are engaged with present moment awareness, our self-referential thoughts are naturally quieted and we get relief from thought-generated suffering. This is how we are designed and how we can leverage this design to experience lives of significantly less suffering and discontentment. Also, when we are abiding in present moment awareness, we are much less likely to get carried away by habitual thoughts and behaviors. We are more likely to see the world as it really is and with fresh eyes. We are less influenced by the default mode network's often erroneous assumptions about ourselves and the world we live in. The neurological basis for this present moment awareness is something called the dorsal attention network, which we will look at next. The dorsal attention network is in charge of present moment awareness. When we are aware of something happening in the present moment, our dorsal attention network comes online and directs this cognition. The object of attention may be external or it can be internal thoughts and feelings. Since it is active in the midst of completing a task that requires present moment awareness, it's sometimes called the task positive network. When the dorsal attention network is active, we are in the moment and our awareness is focused on what is both physically and figuratively right in front of us. So now let's put this together and see how mindfulness works. The default mode network and the dorsal attention network compete with each other for control of awareness. It was mentioned earlier that the present moment awareness is a state of mind, and the trance-like self-referential thinking, or ruminating, is also a state of mind, and only one of these states of mind can be active at the same time. This is made possible by a very useful quirk in our physiology, in that the default mode network and the dorsal attention network cannot be both active at the same time. They work at odds with each other for control over our awareness. Like a seesaw, when the default mode network is raised up and active, the dorsal attention network is lowered and inactive. When the default mode network is active, the brain is free to daydream, fantasize, worry, time travel, crave, and force habitual thinking and behaviors. We see a picture here that kind of shows this. When the default mode network is active, the dorsal attention network is minimized. So in other words, when we're thinking about ourselves, ruminating, we're not really focused too much about what's going on. Another way to state this is the dorsal attention network and the default mode network are anti-correlated. When the dorsal attention network is active, the mind is in a state of present moment awareness and in a stance of receptivity and mental flexibility. Since it shifts down the default mode network, mental time travel, craving, habitual thinking, and behavior are all shut down. This anti-correlation between the attention and the self-absorption centers of the brain is the core driver of how Zen, mindfulness, and meditation works. This by-design aspect of our physiology is the dynamic by which lives can be transformed, formed, and human discontentment can be greatly reduced and perhaps even eliminated. Living a happy life and being effective in your practice becomes simply a matter of increasing the amount of time that the dorsal attention network is in control. It's about living primarily in present moment awareness. The more mindful we are, the less we have self-referential worries about the future. The less we get upset when life does not go our way that we crave it to, and the less we are driven by habitual thinking and behavior. We don't lose the ability to think about the future and plan, but we gain the ability for it not to dominate us. This image here highlights this aspect. When the dorsal attention network is active, in other words, focus attention, the self-absorption area of the brain, or the regions of the brain, the default mode network are lessened. So if we're present and we're focused, we're not worried and ruminating or feeling sad about our life situation. People love taking a break from the default mode network. If this seems a little too abstract, it might be useful to consider that most people do things that shut down the default mode network via awareness all the time in order to take a break from the onslaught of self-referential thinking. Activities such as reading, consuming entertainment, social media, dancing, participating in sports, or playing music are all activities that sharply curtail the activity of the default mode network. Indeed, one of the biggest appeals of all these activities is that they give us a moment of respite from the worries and boredom that we have seen there. And we've seen that these feelings exist due to the default mode network itself. Of course, all those activities that quiet the default mode network are only temporary respites, and many of them can cause their own escapist problems. But they illustrate how much people enjoy breaks from the relentlessness of the default mode network. Escaping the default mode network is a multi-billion dollar business. Luckily, there are other more effective, healthy, and lasting ways to quiet down the default mode network. How can we spend more time in present moment awareness and less time in the default mode self-obsession? The first step towards bringing mindfulness into our lives is simply to decide to deliberately and purposely be aware of the present moment. Note that this did not say something like, decide to not self-referentially think, crave, or act habitually. Remember that the deciding and problem-solving part of the brain is the central executive network. It has a miserable time of directly trying to change the thinking, craving, and automatic behavior of the default mode network. that can it can indirectly do this by invoking present moment awareness. The central executive network cannot decide to simply keep the brain from self-ruminating, but it can decide to pay attention. Deciding to pay attention activates the dorsal attention network. This automatically shuts down the default mode network. The process basically works like this. The central executive network decides to pay attention to the current moment. This causes the dorsal attention network to come online, and the default mode network automatically goes offline because they are physically unable to be both online at the same time. With the default mode network sidelined, we naturally have less worry, craving, and automatic thinking. This image here illustrates the process. The central executive network invokes the dorsal attention network, in other words, the network that focuses on the present moment, and you'll see that this is able to shut down the default mode network. You should know, though, that the default mode network can strike back. In early stages of mindfulness practice, the switch from default mode network to present moment awareness most typically does not last very long. For most people, the default mode network will quickly re-engage if there's nothing that is grabbing our attention. If someone's in the midst of life circumstances that are very stressful or upsetting, the switch back to default mode will be almost instantaneous. This is fine, though. When this happens, the central executive network can simply decide again to purposefully refocus attention in present moment awareness. Then again, again, and again. This manual continuous re-engagement of mindfulness can be very helpful in two ways. The first way is that if we do this frequently, we can use it tactically to stay in present when our mind starts spinning off out of control. It's a good way to break cycles of worry and habitual behavior. Sometimes just a few moments of clarity can make a big difference. The second way that continuous re-engagement of present moment awareness via deliberate activation of the dorsal attention network is helpful is that slowly, over time, we start changing our brains in very important ways that allow mindful awareness to engage on its own without the need for a purposeful and willful decision to do so. This continual re-engagement of awareness training is called meditation, and it involves yet another brain network called the salience network. I apologize for introducing yet another network, and we did talk about this briefly earlier, but really, to really understand how mindfulness and meditation works, we really do need to touch on the salience network. The salience network is the brain network that is in charge of quietly running in the background while scanning our bodies and the world around us for events and information that might be useful to know about. You could say it's the sensory traffic control part of the brain. If nothing of importance is happening in the current moment, it lets the default mode network continue to use its downtime to worry, daydream, fantasize, or act or think habitually. If something does happen that requires immediate attention, it shuts down the default mode network and turns on the dorsal attention network in order to pay attention to what has just happened. We have seen how the central executive network can willfully decide to pay attention. Scientists call this top-down awareness control. But when the salience network stops self-referential thinking and invokes attention, this is called bottom-up awareness control. It is present moment awareness that does not require a conscious decision to invoke. The subconscious salience network can invoke awareness without us deciding it needs to happen. This slide shows this dynamic in action. The salience network invokes awareness when something important happens. So, for example, let's say you hear the squeaking of car tires. That will get your attention, and the dorsal attention network will come online, see what's going on, and daydreaming about the past or worrying about the future with the default mode network gets turned off. This is really important, so let's take a look at it one last time. These are the sequence of events that allows the salience network to hijack awareness and control attention on a normal and regular basis. The salience network or the traffic control, notices something worthy of attention and activates the dorsal attention network, which is in charge of focused attention. When the dorsal attention network comes online, the default mode network automatically goes offline because they are both physically unable to both be online at the same time. The mind is now naturally in an alert and mindful mode of operation. And now we have all the pieces, or the neurological puzzle pieces, to understand how mindfulness training, in other words, meditation, works. Perhaps the most fascinating insight that has emerged out of the scientific investigation into mindfulness is that when you look at the brain scans of experienced meditators, you find that even in a resting state, the default mode networks are relatively quiet. Normally, an external or internal important alert needs to switch from the default mode network to alertness. But by contrast, experienced meditators have buffed up their salience network in a way that allows it to maintain relaxed alertness just out of habit. Another scientific finding explains how this is accomplished. Meditation actually physically changes the salience network in ways that cause it to keep present moment awareness active more and more of the time. These physical changes include increased size and folding of key salience network brain regions, as well as improved connectivity to other brain regions. The primary point to comprehend here is that these are physical changes. The life changes that emerge from mindfulness practice do not come from adopting a new philosophy or having a new psychological outlook on life. They come from the repetitive exercise of focusing awareness during meditation and the resulting physical changes in the brain. An analogy can be made to weightlifting. Your muscles do not get stronger through any sort of thinking. We need to physically lift heavy weights to change the muscle size and structure. In the same way, the salience network is not buffed up via any sort of thinking. It too requires repetitive exercises to have its physical size and structure change. And those repetitive exercises are invoking current moment awareness. Mindfulness practice is not the adoption of new ideas to replace old ones. This would be like trying to wipe away oil with more oil. Instead of adopting a new way of thinking about the world, mindfulness practice changes our relationship to thinking itself. It's a change in the very way we exist in the world. It's a transformation of how awareness functions in our lives. The ability for the brain to change its physical structure and functioning in an enduring manner is based on these experiences is called neural plasticity. As we have seen, the primary way mindfulness and meditation changes our brain via neuroplasticity is the strengthening of the salience network. Importantly and interestingly, this is not the only neuroplastic change to the brain that is a result of mindfulness and meditation. Scientists have discovered many others. Some of these discoveries are: mindfulness helps us relax and have less stress. Mindfulness allows us to physiologically have less generalized fear in our lives. Mindfulness helps us feel physical and emotional pain with much less intensity, enabling us to experience life with much more equanimity. Mindfulness helps us have more resilience and allows us to bounce back quicker when we're upset. Mindfulness helps us have more objectivity, which allows us to catch and stop ourselves from acting habitually to life stresses. In short, scientists have found in study after study that meditation has significant positive benefits to our lives, and that these benefits are lasting and permeate our lives even when we are not actively meditating. Let's take a moment here to sum up what we've covered so far. We've covered a lot of information, so let's take a moment to review what we've seen. Humans frequently feel dissatisfaction with life because a powerful brain network called the default mode network shapes who we think we are and generates intense expectations about what it thinks must happen for us to feel safe and happy. The default mode network spends an inordinate amount of time being upset when its expectations are not met, or by worrying that they may not be met in the future. The default mode network also forces us to think and act habitually in ways that often cause unnecessary problems and drama in our lives. The brain network that is in charge of purposeful analysis and problem solving, the central executive network, is almost completely incapable of direct control over the default mode network. As a result, we can rarely think away our problems and find it very hard to avoid them. Luckily, it is possible for the central executive network to indirectly rein in the default mode network by invoking the brain network responsible for present moment awareness. Default mode habitual rumination and present moment awareness are anti-correlated. When one is active, the other is shut down. Invoking present moment awareness indirectly shuts down the default mode network's ability to crave, worry, and behave in habitual manners. In early stages of practice, it is necessary to tactically and purposefully invoke present moment awareness to shut down the default mode network. With lots of formal meditation practice, a brain network called the salience network gets physically strengthened to the point where it just naturally invokes present moment awareness most of the time without us even having to try. And this, of course, means the default mode network and its self-referential rumination and worrying and sadness gets downgraded and does not control our lives to the same degree. This presentation showed that mindfulness can help us improve our mental health in two ways. The first is tactical mindfulness, where we purposefully decide to be in present moment awareness. And this, of course, shuts down the default mode network, which in turn reduces the amount of time that we're ruminating or worrying or feeling sad or just litigating the past and just not living presently. And then secondly, there's long-term mindfulness meditation, where being in the moment becomes the default and natural way of being. For most of us, the first type of mindfulness is the most relevant, so let's look at some ways that we can get better at this. Setting a mindfulness timer. Many mindfulness apps on mobile phones have a feature that will alert us with a little ding that will remind us to be randomly mindful of the present moment. This helps us touch base and be aware of the present moment. Now, another practical approach is noticing when we get upset. When we find ourselves getting mad or angry, this is when two problems can pop up. We can act in a way that, you know, psychologists and mindfulness people say call unskillful, often in a habitual manner. Like, we may get angry, we may lash out, we may do some sort of escapist activity, something unhelpful, something unskillful. We can also get lost in stressful and depressive rumination. In both cases, it is the default mode network that is causing the problems. So we can tactically decide to engage present moment awareness, and this can often really help. We often don't feel better instantly, but we can control our behavior better and start to unwind the rumination, which just gets us back to baseline a lot quicker. Let us try to make this concrete by looking at a specific example. Let's say hypothetically you have a coworker at your firm that has been a constant source of irritation for you. Their problems are almost endless. They are rude, their confidence is questionable, and you just don't like their arrogant personality. An arrogance that seems to be spectacularly unearned. You are working on a project together, and they are grating on your nerves more and more. Not only are they not doing their work, their rudeness and incompetence are starting to affect your own work. And it all comes to a head one day while you're in a conference room with your client, two partners in the firm, and your annoying coworker. While you're getting ready to start your presentation, your coworker butts in and says, "Thanks everyone for coming here. I would like to take this time to present the work we've done so far." He then dives into a presentation where it makes it look like he gets most of the credit and your own role is minimized. On one level, being upset at the situation is perfectly reasonable. It is not unreasonable to be annoyed by your coworker's incompetence and rudeness. It is even more reasonable to be upset that he cut you off at a meeting with partners and clients and made his role seem more important than it was while minimizing your own. These are real concerns that need to be managed. Our central executive network can likely analyze the situation and come up with some reasonable solutions to mitigate and perhaps even resolve the issues. Maybe it's time to start talking to a managing partner and ask for advice regarding what's going on. Maybe it's time to talk to your coworker in a productive manner. Certainly you need to calmly talk to some people about what is now going on in this meeting. These are all reasonable reactions that the central executive network can come up with. But is that how we always deal with these issues? Are we always like Spock from Star Trek, where we let reason win the day? Sometimes, but not always. Let's say that in this scenario, your default mode network gets the best of you. The Spock part of your brain is overwhelmed. Instead of calmly dealing with the issue when it makes sense, the way that it's in your benefit, the default mode network does something to it. The first thing that happens is that your adrenaline starts rushing. Then you start ruminating. How could this jerk be doing this? The meeting ends and everyone parts ways. The client leaves and everyone goes to their offices. But you just can't stop ruminating. The unfairness of the situation just stuns you. Your mind will just not stop racing. The ruminative thought just won't stop. Then an hour later, you and your annoying coworker are walking into another meeting together with another partner. As you sit down, he jokes with you. Hey, dude, that's my chair. At this point, you just lose it. You make a huge scene and angrily cuss him out. You launch into a 2-minute meltdown where you air all your grievances about the day. Rant is over, and you look at the other people in the room. Your annoying coworker is looking at you with a half astonished and half amused look on his face. Your partner looks stunned and disappointed at you. He cancels the meeting and says he needs to talk to you. You messed up. With your outburst, you have subtly damaged your standing and reputation. What happened here? Your default mode network will just not stop reading it. It caused you to get more and more worked up. It overwhelmed the central executive network's clock-like ability to deal with the situation and you reacted foolishly and emotionally. Remember, your concerns were valid. This guy's a problem. This is not in dispute. But your default mode network and its rumination kept you from dealing with it in a skillful manner. And now, of course, your outburst is the source of new rumination about making a fool of yourself. Your weekend is ruined. So what could you have done differently? In the meeting, when your default mode network was winding you up and up, that would have been a perfect time to use some tactical mindset. You could have used your central executive network and say, I have to get my attention into the present moment and short circuit this rumination. At that point, you could have brought your attention to your breathing, perhaps. That, or just bringing your attention to the present moment in and of itself. At the point you did that, your dorsal attention network would have been engaged, and your default mode network would have chilled out. You are upset, so you would have had to keep doing this over and over again. It is very likely you would have been enough to manage the rumination and not lose your cool. This might be an overly dramatic example, but it really does show one practical way how mindfulness can work in our lives. Personally, I have a lot less drama and deal with things in better ways once I really made an effort to be more mindful. Now let's look at one more way we could bring mindfulness into our professional lives. Another thing you can do as an attorney regarding mindfulness is actually review the ABA rules. This may seem like an extraordinarily strange point to reference in the context of mental health and mindfulness, but many of the things that cause us stress and depression come from how we behave and treat other people. Things can come back to bite us. So by prophylactically behaving better, we're less likely to cause stress in our lives. When we affirm our commitment to practicing law ethically, that plants a seed that reminds us to be tactically mindful when we are engaging in decisions making processes regarding professional activities. If you have any comments or questions about this presentation or even complaints, please do not hesitate to contact me. My address is Barry, with an E, barry.crawford@mclez.com. Hopefully this presentation has been at least a little bit helpful.